I want you to close your eyes just for a moment. Just close them. And I want you to think, what is the most breathtaking mountain view you have ever seen? You got the picture? There may be several. Okay, you can open your eyes now. I just want you to keep that in mind. I think one of the ones for me, as many times as I've been to the Rocky Mountains now because my sons live in Denver, I think one of the ones that I remember as almost surreal in its beauty was, it was kind of high up on a ridge. It was in Moab. My sister owns a condo down in Moab, Utah, and they have huge caverns, not caverns. You stand on top of the mountain, you see all kinds of just, it's a beauty, canyons, okay? It's not the Grand Canyon, but I'll tell you what, I've never seen the Grand Canyon, but I would be surprised if the Grand Canyon tops what I saw there. The beauty of it was just breathtaking, so magnificent, and the colors in the rawness of the stones, I keep that in my mind when I think about when I want to think of something really breathtaking. That's one that I go to. Are you aware of how many times God revealed himself on mountains? It's quite often. Quite often he does that. The mountains are not necessarily more holy than any other place. I don't know that the view is any more breathtaking than maybe any other place. I think the view of watching the sunrise on the ocean is pretty breathtaking. It seems kind of plain, but it's pretty magnificent to just imagine the vastness of the ocean and seeing the sun come up. But it's on these mountains that God has, in fact, chosen to reveal himself. And there are certain things he does reveal about himself in these things. So think of ourselves this morning as sort of going on a little bit of a journey to various mountains. And you think of them in any way you can imagine the beauty of them. But I want you to also think, what do you see on the same mountains that other individuals have seen when they experienced God? We turn, first of all, to Genesis chapter 22. A familiar story to us, but on a mountain nonetheless. Abraham is called by God to take his only son and to sacrifice him to God on the mountain. And it's a different, a rather interesting story, is it not? Interesting is a mild word to put it in a different sort of way. First of all, Abraham had to travel 3 days to get to this Mount Moriah, it's called. And in verses 9 through 14, the passage that was read this morning, we see that Abraham was willing to do what God told him to do on this mountain. And when he's on this mountain, as he begins to prepare the sacrifice of his son, he is stopped from doing that. And he's stopped from doing that, and it's on this mountain that he experiences the living God. It's really the climax of what has been a lifetime of experience with the living God, because some 20 years before this, that same God has come to Abraham and said, Abraham, I'm going to make a covenant with you. First of all, you're going to have a son, and all nations are going to be blessed because of you and because of your descendants. And they go through years of struggling to figure out, Abraham goes through years of struggling to figure out how that's going to happen because he has no descendants. Then he has a child. He and his wife have a child in their old age. His name is Isaac. And as you can imagine, being the only child, being a child of their old age, he's extremely precious to them. You just cannot imagine how precious, perhaps, that child is, except, you know, when you look at your own children and see how precious they are to you. And yet he's told to go and sacrifice them. Give them back to God. Well, the writer in Hebrews 11, verses 17 through 19, really kind of tells us what Abraham is thinking. He is totally confident during this whole 3 days journey. And apparently he knows that, you know, if in fact he dies, God can raise him back from the dead and give him back to him. So he shows remarkable faith here. And we know that God really never expects that kind of human sacrifice. But this test is for Abraham and to see what kind of faith he has. So what do we see in Abraham? We see a complete and total faith. The kind of faith that acts, the kind of faith that is so totally willing to let God be his refuge, that he's willing to give back to God the thing God had given to him. We see faith, do we not? As we move a little bit further on in the Old Testament, we come to King David. And several passages here, I'm not going to go to all of them, but just to kind of give you some idea. 2 Samuel chapter 24, 1 Chronicles chapter 22 verse 1, and 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1. It's the story about when David tries to number his fighting men. And even his general says, you know, we really shouldn't be doing this because it shows lack of faith in God. And in fact, it did show lack of faith in God, and God starts to punish Israel and Jerusalem for it. And David's he's struck with guilt over it, and he finds out what he has to do. And what he ends up having to do is he has to go and he has to buy a place in Jerusalem to offer a sacrifice. And when he offers the sacrifice, the plague that had started in Jerusalem stops. Now, what's interesting about that place, we find out in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1, that very place, well, we find out two things. Number one, it's the place where David wants the temple built. We also find out it's the place called Mount Moriah, where Abraham offered his son as a sacrifice. And so we sort of have this full circle of coming back to this mountain again, where we have another experience of God, and where David experiences the atonement and forgiveness of God for what he has done. And he says, this is going to be the place where people are going to be able to do that regularly. And it becomes the place where the temple is built. It is the site of the mountain of God. It is the site of the temple. It is the place where, as Solomon says in his dedicatory prayer at the temple, where people can come and commune with God and find forgiveness with God. What do we see at this Mount Moriah again? Now we see atonement. We see a place of worship and prayer. We see God establishing and continuing his promises of the covenant to Abraham. So we see some continuity. Same mountain, slightly different view, but we still see and experience with the living God. Well, I've passed over one of the mountains that actually occurred, or one of the experiences, and that was Moses on the mountain of God. We know that Moses goes up on Mount Sinai to receive the law. And if you turn to the book of Exodus, this time chapter 20, we'll look at one or two passages here in the book of Exodus. One of them is in chapter 20, verses 18 through 21. It says, now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die. Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that you fear him, or that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin. The people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. It's a very interesting scene. Can you get the picture there? Can you see the smoke rising from the mountain? Can you feel the trembling of the earth beneath your feet as God has come down on Mount Sinai? Can you see the darkness? And can you see Moses disappear into the darkness as he goes up on the mountain to meet God? Now it seems, as we read through this entire story, Exodus chapter 24, verses 12 through 18, Moses is up there for quite a long time. Either he's gone up several times, or we just have several variations of the way this particular occasion is told to us. We think he's gone up several times. We know that eventually he goes into the tabernacle to meet with God on a regular basis. And we know that because when he comes out, his face is shining and they have to put a veil over his face so that they don't have to look at the brightness of what Moses has been able to sort of absorb from being with God. But what do we see here? well, we see a certain amount of fear. We see an awesome God. But the thing we should see is God's laws revealed to us. Essentially, what we see here is the creator of the world has told us how he has set up mankind and how they should live and work with one another. That's what we see here in God revealing his laws to us. They are not given to us as the 10 suggestions. And God doesn't ask our approval for any of these things. These are the things and the ways that God expects us to live. We break them at risk to our souls and to our eternal destiny. Now Moses further encounters God in Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 through 9. Moses makes a very odd request. He says, I want to see your face. And God says, no, you can't do that. Because you can't do that and live. What I will let you see is, I'll let you see part of me. Okay? So God passes by Moses. He puts his hand over where Moses is so he can't see him. And then he passes by. And Moses hears this expression of just who God is in Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 through 9. And his name, basically, and characteristics of who he is are revealed to Moses. Merciful and gracious. Slow to anger. Abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Keeping steadfast love for thousands. Forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. But who will by no means clear the guilty? That's what Moses experiences about God on the mountain. This is the God who created the world. This is the God who appeared to him in a burning bush. This is the nature of the very power that upholds the universe in which we live and exist. What do we see here? Well, first thing we see is Moses' immediate response is to worship. He says, and Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. I think that was very much an intuitive, natural response to what he saw. I don't think Moses is thinking at this point, well, I better bow down because, you know, God's here, or this is a holy place. He knew it was, but when he saw God, and what little of he saw of God, and what little of the voice he heard from God, that was a natural, intuitive response by one of God's creations, was to bow down and offer him worship, to basically fall on his face, probably put his face to the ground in worship of this God who created him. His second response is to plead for mercy for the sins of him and for this people. He says, if I now have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and our sin and take us for your inheritance. So he asks for forgiveness because he recognizes what he's dealing with. He appeals to God's promise that he's already made, that he has made a covenant with them. But these are the responses that he gets, or that sort of are evoked by Moses when he sees the living God. So we see the nature of God revealed, both in his commandments and in the vision granted to Moses. Can we see and sense perhaps some little way from the awesomeness that we see in the grandeur of the mountains? Can we sense that there's something greater at least? Does it move us to worship? Or do we somehow fool ourselves into thinking that we're the ones who do it all for ourselves? Hopefully, we see the response of worship. I'd like for us to see the nature of God here, because we see that revealed later in Jesus Christ, do we not? And that's what brings us to our last mountain. Maybe not the last in the Bible, but certainly one of the climaxes in Matthew chapter 17 and verses 1 through 9. An interesting passage on a number of levels, the first of which is that Jesus only takes three guys with him. He takes Peter and James and John. And we know something of the history of each three of these guys in the New Testament. And what happens is they get to see Jesus actually transformed essentially into what his true glory looks like. It says in verse 2, "And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light." I don't know what light you think of as the brightest light that you can see, perhaps obviously the sun, which you can't really even stare into, it's so bright. But that's how Jesus looked. I don't know if they could look at it and not have their eyes burned, but it was pretty bright. Jesus himself becomes that bright. Revelation chapter 1, verses 12 through 16, we see a very similar description of the man that John sees later on after Jesus has been glorified. It turns out it is Jesus himself. And we see this a similar picture of brightness and sun and glory and grandeur as he sees Jesus revealing some things to himself again. And so we get this picture. I don't know whether the picture you saw when you closed your eyes earlier involved the sun or the moon, or whether it was nighttime or whether it was during the day. Mine was during the day. It was in the middle of the day. The sun was out. It was bright. It was beautiful. Well, not only do they get to see this picture, not only do they get this vision in there before them, which I'm sure they never forgot. I don't see how they could have ever forgotten such a thing, or how it could not have affected them. But he is also revealed to us as the lone voice of authority on behalf of God. Because they see not only him, but they see Moses and Elijah. Now, we don't have any discussion, so we only, either Moses and Elijah introduce themselves, you know, or they just knew that's who it was. I doubt they had name tags, but somehow they knew it was Moses and Elijah. And when Peter suggests we need to build some booths here for all three of you, suddenly a cloud envelops them. Maybe the vision is gone, but apparently the apostles cannot do anything but fall on their faces. Again, something intuitive, something just happens to them here that brings this out in them. And when they open their eyes, they see only Jesus. This is after, of course, they heard the voice. "This is my son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Listen to him." And when they open their eyes, that's what they see. That's the first thing they see when they open their eyes. Jesus is back to, I want to say normal. He's back to his human form. Probably the transfigured form, that's more like his normal form. What we see is the human form of Jesus. Maybe a little more mundane, but could they ever really see Jesus the same again after this? You know, I would have hated to have been in their shoes when they came down and they said, "You can't tell anybody." Like, what? I mean, you know, I wonder how many times they were tempted. Can I say something now? Can I say, you know, I would have wanted to just blab to everybody. Wait till you hear what I just saw. And yet, we don't get any indication that they did anything but obey this voice of Jesus at this point. Can you see the transfiguration of Jesus through their eyes here? On the mountain? On a place of grandeur, there's a vision of grandeur that even transcends the beauty of the vision maybe on the mountain. I don't know what mountain this was. I don't know how high up it was. I don't know what the surrounding area looked like. I don't even know if there are mountains in Palestine that are above 11,000 feet. Once you get 11,000 feet, you have no trees, and the vision becomes even different. So I don't know what they saw, except that they saw this vision on a place pretty high up. Can you see that transformation yourself? Just think about it and look at it and picture it in your mind. The later witness that they gave would involve and affirm the very things that they saw. They were finally given the opportunity to testify to all those things. Although Jesus commanded them to silence until after the resurrection. After the resurrection, my guess is they blabbed it. To put it in a sort of mundane terms, I don't think they could keep quiet about it, could they? I wouldn't. I wouldn't. I'd tell everybody I knew had I seen that. Well, that's what they did. And Peter affirms it in 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 16 through 18. Peter sort of gives full vent to his eyewitness testimony here. And he talks about how, you know, all the prophets are moved by the Spirit of God to see these things. He says, you can almost read between the lines here, and you can almost hear Peter saying, look, don't tell me that this is not true, because I saw it. We were on that holy mountain with him, and I saw it happen. John will affirm his eyewitness testimony in 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. He doesn't mention the transfiguration. I don't really think he has to. But he at least says, look, we saw it, we touched it, we heard it. You know, we experienced all of this, what we know of as the word of life. This Jesus, this Logos, who is the very power and center of the universe, we experienced it. James, in a sort of, I don't know, a kind of sad situation to me, James doesn't get much of an opportunity to live very long to give his testimony. In Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 2, James is put to death. For all we know, he becomes the second person martyred for his faith. I don't know why God allowed that to happen. James was one of the ones that was on the mountain with him. And yet his life is cut short by Herod, by the evil forces that control this world. But James, nonetheless, was one of the ones who saw that testimony. My guess, he told a lot of people before he was killed. I don't think that's a bad guess to make. But what do we see here, except and other than, can it be anything other than God's Son revealed for the Son and the glory that truly is his? For the individual, for the powerful Son of God that he really is. That's what we see on this mountain. And if you believe it, you really can't come to any other conclusion. You can disbelieve it. You can disbelieve their testimony. But you do so at great risk, I think. Through Jesus, we know that God is present and at work in this evil world. That's what we learn from these mountaintop experiences, all the way from Abraham to Moses to David, all the way up into the time of the apostles. It wasn't always on mountaintops, but there were specific mountaintops that seemed to be climaxes of what God was trying to do, and we clearly see him revealed on those mountains, and we see him coming and being a part of history as a result of those things. Go to the mountains for yourself and experience the same things. And you see, we experience these things through the message of the gospel that was developed through all these years and finally climaxed with the life and death of Jesus Christ. Their witnesses lead us to this message of the gospel. When it's revealed to Cornelius in Acts chapter 10 that he is supposed to hear some message, who does God go to tell them the message? The angel himself doesn't reveal these things to them. What he does is he says, I'm going to bring you a guy who saw all this, and he's going to tell you. That guy happens to be Peter. Now, Peter in that lesson doesn't mention his eyewitness there, but I'm guessing at some point in his discussion with Cornelius, he tells him about that. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't that be one of the things you would say, I can affirm this because I saw him? So the fact is, all of these mountaintop experiences lead us to one thing. They lead us to the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's what they're trying to do. That's the importance of it. Can you see it well enough to believe it? Through their experiences, can you experience it well enough to believe it for yourself? We hear it, and we accept it by faith. We have their witnesses to kind of see the experience for ourselves. When we repent of our sins, that is a result of the faith we have in what they have seen and what we adopt as what they have seen. We confess that Jesus is the true mediator between God and man. We are essentially saying when we confess Jesus as Lord that what Peter and James and John and Saul on the mountain that listened to him was the truth. And so we confess that he is the way to get to God. And when we are baptized to wash away our sins, we are simply responding to the faith that we have and to what we have seen and experienced through them on their mountaintop experiences. This new life leads to a lifetime of obedience and faithfulness. And so I encourage us repeatedly, maybe it's one of those experiences we do from time to time, but simply go to the mountains, believe, and come back with eternal life. Thank you.